Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our tsunami discussion. In a second, I will explain how we propose to proceed this evening. But I think it would be appropriate if we all spent a moment or two in reflection about the human consequences of the tragedy, even though we're going to spend the next hour and a quarter thinking, I hope, rather analytically about it. But we oughtn't to forget that this is, for many people, a deep personal tragedy, and I'd like you to stand and in silence for a moment or two to reflect on that. Now, I'll just spend a moment explaining how we're going to proceed this evening. We have a very distinguished panel, as you can see, with Jude Howell on my immediate right of the Centre of the Study of Civil Society, Kirsten Schultz on her right, Tim Forsyth, Robert Hunter-Wade, and David Jones at the far end. And the way we're going to operate is that Kirsten is going to kick off. She has just been in the region, in fact in Aceh, and she's going to talk about what she saw there, the impact on the society there, the impact on the conflict indeed. And then Tim Forsyth will introduce the debates that I hope we will have by talking about the issues of how to possibly to predict this kind of thing, how to react immediately and what the consequences may be subsequently. And then after their two shortish presentations, we will then have a panel discussion. And I have received already quite a number of questions from across the school, and in good any questions time, I will throw them at members of the panel entirely without warning or preparation. But also, we will take questions from the floor during the course of the evening too. And we aim to wind up at 7:20. So without more ado from me, let me hand over to Kirsten first.
Right. I would like to start off by showing some of the pictures that I took. I was in Indonesia at the time that the tsunami hit. I was not in Aceh, which was actually due to sheer luck, because I've been working on Aceh on the conflict for the last 3 years, and I decided I was going to go diving over Christmas and decided to go somewhere else. So when the tsunami actually hit, I was in a different part of the archipelago, and only rushed there afterwards because, of course, in the process of my 3 years of research, I've made a lot of friends there, and I went to see what happened then. I was there for a couple of days, and I took some pictures, which probably will say much more than I could ever say, to give you a bit of a feeling for the extent of the impact this natural disaster has had on Aceh. I'm going to start off with some aerial shots, where you can see all the areas that are brown on these pictures are areas that were hit by the tsunami, that were flooded, and as a result have sort of just been left like a desert. And the whole sort of coastline has been reshaped. There are parts of Aceh that are still underwater that will probably never reappear.
You can see some remaining houses and everything. This used to be all houses, and you can see just some of them left. Here's an area there which has absolutely nothing left. It's the same thing. This is the harbor in Banda Aceh, the capital city of the province of Aceh. I'm going to show you now a couple of pictures of what it looks like on the ground. Here you can see also quite prominently the effect of the actual earthquake rather than just the tidal wave. This is what the picture looks like once you move from the harbor in direction of the city. That's the main mosque in Banda Aceh, which remains standing. There are several sort of explanations for this. One is that it was an extremely well-built building, which dates back to the colonial times. But also, if you look at the structure, it's a structure that has a lot of columns, so the water was actually able to rush through rather than bump up against it and tear down the structure. That's the minaret. And these are sort of areas that just had normal houses. These are residential areas which have been totally wiped out. The force of the tsunami was actually so big that a lot of ships that were in the harbor or around the coast were actually just sort of picked up and thrown right into the city center. And to give you an idea, the city center, if you go by car to the coast, takes about 20 minutes. So it's not really literally on the coast. But you have ships sitting in the center right next to shops, rammed into hotels. Here's one of the more recent acquisitions of the police. They had been so proud to have new speedboats. Now you see one of them jumbled right into the middle of houses. This was a police station, which totally collapsed. This area used to house the dormitories of the younger police, the unmarried ones. They're all gone as well. Some 3,000 police died in the tsunami, plus families. Here you see some residents trying to sort of dig out what was left in terms of possessions, trying to recover. They found a motorbike, and they think they're going to be able to sort of get that going again. This is the site that you saw most prominently during the first 2 weeks after the tsunami, where we had some 166,000 bodies underneath the rubble. And most of the volunteers who had rushed to Banda Aceh to help found themselves faced with a job that their primary job was to literally to dig out bodies. There were students from all universities across Indonesia. There were foreign volunteers who were looking for bodies. They packed them up in whatever they could find. They left them on the side of the road, and either the Indonesian military or a team that was sent by Yemen with trucks went to collect these bodies every day. This is what this sort of looked like once they dug them out. Here you see the trucks collecting the bodies and putting them into sort of proper body bags. Here you see one of the teams of soldiers who were volunteering taking a break, sitting in the midst of the rubble to have a cigarette. You're fishing for bodies in the water. Here's a picture of some of the Indonesian volunteers who were going to the direction of Banda Aceh. They were flying in a military plane, which collected bags along the way. And this was a really sort of positive picture, because every single airport in Indonesia, people were bringing bags of clothes and food, whatever they wanted to contribute, and they were just piling them up. And the Indonesian military would put them on the planes along with volunteers and take them to Banda Aceh. Which we also had foreign militaries. Here you see the Australians, who were providing water desalination equipment and handing out water every day. And here's the last picture I'm going to show you, is the arrival, which was right on the last day when I was there, of the Pakistani troops who had come to help with the reconstruction, who were going to deal with the clearing of roads and rebuilding of roads. Now that's sort of a bit of a pictorial impression of what was going on in Aceh. If you read the press of what was going on at the time, there were a lot of sort of allegations that the Indonesian government didn't respond quickly enough, that aid efforts weren't coordinated, and that was true to a large degree. But when you sort of went to sort of see what was going on the ground, there was a problem with coordination. But it was a problem that was caused by a destroyed infrastructure, None of the phone lines were working anymore. Most of the roads were destroyed. The bridges were washed out. The airport in Banda Aceh had been used to 4 flights a day and all of a sudden found itself faced with 200 flights a day. The air control tower staff was less able to cope with that. There was clogging up in some of the other regional airports like Medan, where you had a situation where flights would circle over at Medan before they could fly on to Banda Aceh. So that was a big infrastructural challenge for the situation. There was another big issue that happened is that once the first sort of shock was over, the situation got politicized very quickly. And there were ultra-nationalists in the Indonesian government who criticized foreign involvement. There were Muslims who criticized the charity coming in from Christian aid organizations, claiming that they were using the opportunity to convert people. There was, of course, an ongoing separatist conflict in Aceh as well. And the rebels started accusing the military of exploiting the opportunity to wipe out the rest of the Acehnese. Similarly, the military accused the rebels of starting to attack aid workers. And that was really, really detrimental because it hindered the coordination, it politicized things unnecessarily, and the sort of people who suffered in the end were the internally displaced persons, the Acehnese. I think I will leave it at that point and hand over to Tim for some more analysis.
Thanks, Chris. Tim.
Well, these last 2 or 3 weeks, we've all been watching these images of the tsunami and the earthquake, and it's been obviously something which has left lasting impressions of the tragedy and the impact of this kind of event. The death toll, of course, is, depending on various scenarios, it raises either between 170,000 to 220,000 or 230,000, with still people missing. And of course, the physical damage has been quite huge as well. Banda Aceh has been estimated to have lost about $4.4 billion to £2 or 3 million, and that's in the damage to the actual infrastructure and land which has happened there. So the questions are, what can we do about this? A further image has been the sense of tragedy, which I think has been portrayed in the press as being something which we have shared with the actual countries affected because of the amount of tourists and visitors there. On one hand, this has been a good thing by generating a large flow of funds from the public in the other countries. But on the other hand, it has led to certain accusations that we've been engaging in disaster pornography, or the sense in which we're intruding onto other people's suffering as a result of this dramatic event. The question is, what I'm trying to talk about today is, what can we do about this? What are the lessons? How can we learn from this sort of event? First point is, how can we warn ourselves against this kind of event happening? Now, much discussion so far has called for an early warning system. The obvious question is this enough? Is this justified? Would it work? The problem about the tsunami, though, has to be that actually this kind of event at this kind of level is relatively rare. Probably, it's very difficult to look at records, but definitely the last major tsunami at this sort of level was in 1883 at the explosion of Krakatoa Island in Indonesia, just about there. Now that was caused by a volcanic eruption. It wasn't caused by an earthquake like this. So it's very difficult to predict this sort of thing. There are other events, of course, which cause similar damage, perhaps, but not necessarily caused in the same way. Like there was a typhoon in the south of Thailand in 1983, which killed some 10,000 people. And then in Orissa, there's a major cyclone in 1999, which killed many more. The point is that there is plenty of disaster in this part of the world, but it isn't necessarily tsunamis. So it's unlike the Pacific Ocean, for example, where the USA has had a tsunami warning device since 1948. But the question is it worth looking at in this part of the world? This is what a tsunami warning system would look like. We have the detector device on the ground, on the floor of the sea, which then transmits to a buoy, which then goes to satellite and onwards. Now, as it happens, the American system in Hawaii did actually detect the quake in Aceh some 15 minutes after it happened. It then had to evaluate it and check it, and when it became clear that it was over 6.5 on the Richter scale, it then triggered warning responses to the region. So it actually did warn the region of the Bay of Bengal about what was happening. It generated some 25,000 emails because of that response. However, it was generally speaking too late to take any action. As I'm sure you can realize, any prediction system like this is as good as the dissemination and communication device on the ground. And that's essentially an issue of how far authorities are able to communicate to the radios and the televisions and how far people are listening to those things on the ground. And given that the wave was traveling at some, 800 kilometers an hour, and it would take about two and a half hours to get from Indonesia to Sri Lanka, there's not much time to deal with that sort of thing. So we have to be careful about what actually happens with the warning system. Second question is what to do when the wave hits. This is a photograph showing the north coast of Bandar Aceh before and after the event, and you can see the tremendous damage happening. Now, in the press, it's been popular to represent this as very much a shared tragedy. There's great equality in the suffering. There have been some high-profile casualties. The grandson of a Thai king was killed. I understand that Lord Attenborough, Richard Attenborough's granddaughter, was killed, and his daughter is still missing. Helmut Kohl was stranded on his hotel in Sri Lanka for half a day. Yet, at the same time, there's also great inequality in this kind of suffering. In this part of the world, it is quite usual for women and children not to be taught to swim in the same way as men are. So arguably, the men are better able to survive this kind of event. We also have had attention to the number of orphans. Indonesia apparently has 14,000 orphans, or children separated from parents. Now, obviously, these are much more vulnerable in the aftermath, in the sense that they need looking after. They don't have as easy access to the services. Similarly, there are many laborers who are also less able to access the aid and assistance. Thailand has many Burmese laborers who are not formally registered, and consequently, we don't really know how many Burmese laborers have been killed in this. Now, the third point is to work out what to do about all this. Here's another picture, which shows a wider image of the Aceh coastline. And you can see that the wave has gone in this case, about 1 or 2 kilometers inland, taking out a lot of the agriculture, aquaculture, which is the cultivation of fish on the coastlines, and also the fishing industries as well. In fact, the UN estimates that 30% of casualties are in agriculture, 10% in fishery. Now, how are we going to rebuild this? What are the sense of the way in which aid can help? Well, clearly, there's a lot of money being generated, but there are other things happening as well. The Paris Club, which is a collection of crediting nations which give debt to the developing world, have agreed a debt moratorium for the countries affected, which basically means that the countries don't have to repay their debts for the time being, so they can liberate funds to deal with the disaster. Now, Sri Lanka and Indonesia have said yes to this. Thailand, on the other hand, have said no, we aren't interested. Largely because to take that sort of action would damage its credit rating and would interfere with its ability to trade under normal circumstances. But there are other issues as well. Thailand essentially wants a reduction in its tariffs, which the rest of the world imposes upon its shrimp exports, which it cultivates in land a little bit like this, along the coastlines of southern Thailand. It's interesting that the EU has imposed a 12% tariff on shrimp from Thailand. And the USA has imposed a 97% tariff, which the Thai government claims costs them £400 million a year. Now, as it happens, they are currently negotiating this within the trade round talks. And so it's kind of embarrassing and unfortunate for the EU to have this sort of thing raised at the moment. But it's interesting that at the same time as people are talking about aid to Thailand for this sort of region, one of the bigger questions is, well, how can we actually integrate whatever we're doing with their ability to trade and make livelihoods in other ways? Indeed, if you want to read some of the more controversial Sunday newspaper reports, there was one report that said that the EU is currently trying to negotiate with Thailand about its shrimp exports and the tariffs, but only if Thai Airways buys the Airbus A380, which is the large super jumbo jet. Of course, we remain to see whether that's actually borne out and what actually happens. Now, there are other worrying things as well. There's one topic of debate today is whether actually the tsunami was enhanced by the removal of mangrove forests. Now, it's unclear as to what the impact of leaving mangrove forests alone is. I personally would have thought that there are many reasons to conserve mangrove forest, but to conserve it only on the basis of a tsunami event, which might happen every 100 years or so, isn't necessarily the best reason for doing that. There are other reasons. There are other issues as well going on. There's a disturbing report that Bandai Aceh has received some 300 members of Christian groups who are actively seeking to convert local Muslim people to Christianity as part of the aid relief. Meanwhile, in Sri Lanka, the attempts to overcome the 20-year civil war in that region has led to some concern that the government's trying to intervene to mix settlements afterwards, to mix Tamil people with the Sinhalese in ways which are not necessarily popular amongst both groups. Again, all these issues remain to be seen as to how they're going to be borne out. The question is, however, what can we do now to deal with this? Clearly, the big topic now people are talking about is an early warning system. At the current cost of about £15 million, which is what people are talking about, I can't see any reasons why we can't have an early warning system as long as it's integrated with warnings like this, for example, which are from the Pacific coast, from either Washington, that's from New Zealand, the black one, and from Mexico. But the lesson from development studies is that focusing only upon the physical event, predicting the physical event, be it an earthquake or a tsunami or whatever, is not enough. What we have to do is to integrate that kind of warning with a long-term process of actually reducing the vulnerability of different places and different people to whatever kind of disaster happens, be it a tsunami or a cyclone or a typhoon or whatever. And at that point, I'll end.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much, Tim. Can I summon the other two members of the panel? Thanks. Fascinating, some of the stories that you produce. It can only be a matter of time before the current Secretary of State for Education is accused of sending Opus Dei to convert in Indonesia. Now, the questions that I've had submitted from the school, I'm going to take two or three of those first, but I hope that I'll come to the audience very quickly, so do be thinking about what you want to ask. And let's start. There was a question precisely about the early warning system. Let me put this to David, where the question is, an early warning system would serve only to create a state of perceived security. There is little chance of information really reaching the people who need it most, the vulnerable living on the fringes. Should the money spent on this harebrained scheme not be diverted to more tangible coastal protection measures?
Yes, thank you, Howard. I think there's no choice at the moment. People in Southern Asia have lived through a truly disastrous event, and they want to take every possible precaution against it in the future. And one possibility is an early warning system. And I think it's politically unacceptable to say, no, we won't have an early warning system. Politicians of the regions won't do that. What they will do is blame shift, if you like, by developing an early warning system, and then if it happens again, you blame the scientists for not issuing the warning early enough. So I think there will be an early warning system developed. It won't be terribly effective because, in fact, there isn't enough time. As Tim has clearly shown, northern Sumatra was, in fact, hit by the waves within an hour of the earthquake. And in the case of Sri Lanka and India, they were hit within 1.5 to 2 hours of the actual earthquake. There isn't enough time to actually get a very good warning system operational. It would be based on telecommunications of one sort or another and a siren system, which may be a graded system, so it would start off with short pulses for an alert, longer pulses for a warning, and then a continuous siren sounding for an evacuation. But there isn't actually enough time in many cases. So we have to move away from this fix with warning systems. It's currently very much in vogue to go for warning systems and assume that, in fact, then you are safe. It's a form of the Levee syndrome. Do something and you assume everything is all right. That you actually have to do something to control vulnerability. There's hazard and vulnerability combined to cause loss. So you have to look at what ways it is possible to reduce the vulnerability of the communities along any potentially threatened coastlines. You can do this in a number of ways. You can do engineering structures of one sort or another, but that sort of mega engineering with big sea walls is all right for Japan, but it's not actually all right for Southern Asia. It's far too expensive. But in more vulnerable locations, you could put engineering structures. You can put various forms of beach defenses and wave spoilers, as they're known, large masses of rock which actually break up waves as they come in. That will reduce the potency of the incoming tsunamis. And you can develop vegetation belts, including mangroves, to sort of dissipate the energy. So there are a number of ways in which you could actually try to reduce the hazard threat along coastlines. But nevertheless, you have to focus on the vulnerable populations. Got a very clear hazard zonation now, because you can see the areas from air photographs that have been devastated. It isn't a long mapping program which is required now. It's there, quite clearly in front of your face. What you have to do is to try and implement some sort of land use zonation or some sort of building zonation to go in line with the hazard zonation that you've identified. Clearly, you've got to try and get simple solutions and cheap solutions rather than expensive solutions. But you can actually build buildings that are more capable of withstanding the force of the sea. You can actually put buildings on stilts to actually mean that, in fact, they are at least safe from small tsunamis, perhaps not the mega one that we've had recently. You could relocate villages to higher ground, difficult. You could relocate villages on top of mounds. I have them in Holland, they're called Turpen, quite used to the sea in Holland. Or you can actually go the way of Bangladesh in terms of the cyclone sea surge threat there, where you have cyclone shelters, which are shelters on stilts, which if the warning sounds, the people flee up the steps into the shelter and wait for the water to come in and go out again. So there are a combination of things that have to be done. But a warning system on its own is not enough. There have to be planning measures, there have to be building measures that will seek to protect the vulnerable populations along the coastlines.
Thank you, David. Well, we may come back to that, but let me try and in the initial questions to get a number of the issues on the table. And you've talked about the environmental issues, mangrove swamps, etc. And I've got a question here. Let me throw this at Tim. I think is how much do you think global tourism is responsible for the scale of the disaster, especially the taste of Western tourists for beaches and waterfronts, which I guess is also about whether that has created a different environment that is particularly vulnerable to this kind of event.
Well, I think the short answer to that is that any development which brings people to the coastline, which is susceptible to tsunamis, obviously will increase the vulnerability to tsunamis. However, that in itself is not an answer for, it's not a recipe for stopping global tourism. Like I said, the dilemma with tsunamis, that's at the moment a major disaster. We're very worried about it, but over a longer time period, there are many other factors to be concerned about as well. Now, we may go about doing tourism development in a different way, for example, in increasing greater rights for local workers, increasing a better deal for local workers so that whilst the tourists may live in big hotels, the local people who service the tourist industries don't have to live in vulnerable villages close to the water. But I think that in itself is a wider question relating to how we undergo that kind of sustainable tourism development. I don't think it is a right answer simply just to blame global tourism itself.
Thanks. Yeah, just.
I'd like to add that the hardest affected area was Aceh, and Aceh doesn't have tourism. So I think on that basis, maybe tourism can sort of scale down as a factor. Aceh has been in a conflict for the last 30 years. It's been on occasion closed to foreigners. On other occasions, tourists just don't like to go to conflict areas. So if tourists go to Indonesia, they go to Bali, they go to other parts. So tourism hasn't really been a factor at all in the case of
Aceh. Thanks. We move on to the issue of the Western response, and I've got one here that I think I'll throw at Robert. Is debt relief really the best thing that world governments can offer? What about making trade terms fairer or allowing freer movement of labour?
So is debt relief the best that can be offered? I think you have to distinguish between measures which are done in the West targeted at the reconstruction of livelihoods for the people who remain in these areas, from the question of using this as a window of opportunity to get Western governments and publics to take measures which, although not specifically targeted at the people who are affected, would nevertheless have a chance of increasing development more generally, and that would in a more indirect and diffuse way help the long-term reconstruction of the tsunami-affected areas. I don't see that debt relief or a kind of generalized improvement in trade access for exports from these countries would do very much to, in a direct sense, improve the restoration of livelihoods for those who have lost them. There are too many intervening factors between debt relief and lower tariffs on their exports for that to be an important factor. And remember that debt relief is a misleading term. What is promised is simply a delay, at least this is what looks likely to happen, a delay in the repayment of interest and debt service, rather than any kind of writing off of either the interest repayments or the debt itself. It's simply a delay, but it gets presented in the public arena as a great act of generosity. So I think we should be a bit careful about thinking that the kind of promises that have been made in the West are really going to do very much. But just finally, let me mention that there may be quite specific exports, such as the shrimp exports, where you can see a direct link between improved access to Western markets for shrimp and the restoration of the livelihoods of a large number of affected people in specific places. So I'm putting that aside, but in the general case, I don't think debt relief or improved trade access is going to be of much direct help.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to just take one more of the questions submitted and then turn it over to you. So I hope you're thinking about your questions. And Jude, who is hiding here behind, won't be surprised that this one's coming to her. Has the unprecedented generosity for the Asian tsunami come at the expense of charitable donations to other needy areas, or will the tsunami act as a signal change, and will we see personal charitable donations increase in the longer term?
Okay, thank you. I think it's very difficult to ascertain actually whether personal or private charitable donations have actually come at the expense of other needy areas. We know that overseas relief in the UK accounts for about 10% of all private charitable donations, and the largest amount of charitable donations goes to medical research or charities working with children or young people. I think we won't know until later whether there has been any shift. But I think there are two related issues. One is whether personal private giving will actually increase, and second, whether there has been a diversion of resources in terms of government funding. And just on the government issue, I think if we have seen a diversion of government, it is likely that we'll see a diversion of government aid money from other problems with tsunami-like proportions. Governments are well known for making wonderful pledges in times of disaster, but are also very well known for breaking their promises. The good news is that France and the Netherlands and Canada have all said that they will donate new money. The EU has promised not to divert money, but we know the US and the UK have not said very much, except Hilary Benn has said that they will donate £40 million to the UN's immediate relief effort. But two-thirds of this is actually coming out of reserves, not out of new money itself. And of course, we saw in the case of Iraq that relief and reconstruction work is being funded through the diversion of aid resources. And it's quite remarkable at the moment that Iraq is the largest recipient of bilateral aid in the UK, receiving £200 million a year. At the same time, DFID has considerably cut its programs for Latin and Central America in the past 2 years and frozen the planned increase in its program to China. But I think importantly, what we need to do is to press governments to actually live up to their aid commitments, because we know that although overseas aid as a percentage of GDP has increased under the current government, we're still very far from the commitment to achieving 0.7% of GDP being devoted to aid. And this is really quite poor when you compare it to other countries, much smaller economies, such as Denmark and the Netherlands. Perhaps even more embarrassing is the fact that the USA, one of the world's obviously largest economies, spends only 0.15% of its GDP on aid. So coming back to the issue of, well, are people going to give more now? Is this a signal for the future that they're going to give more? Again, I think it's difficult to say. I mean, what research done by the Charity Aid Foundation shows that giving to charity is not actually a very high priority for people. People have been remarkably generous in the recent tsunami, and private donations from the UK have been much higher than for other economies. The UK public has given privately four times as much as the US public and twice as much as the German and French public. So that's all very good sign. But will donations increase in the future? I think, first of all, charity itself, or the idea of donations, has to become more of a priority. And second, I think there needs to be greater attention to the role of NGOs, humanitarian NGOs and development NGOs in the public mind. I mean, what is quite interesting, I think, at the Jakarta summit was that humanitarian NGOs were not included in the discussions about the response to the tsunami disaster, even though it is NGOs, humanitarian NGOs, who are on the ground actually delivering aid.
Thank you. Well, let me throw it open to the audience now, and if you could say, give your name, and if you want to direct it at a particular member of the panel, then do so, otherwise I will choose arbitrarily. A woman there in the fourth row. There's a mic, I think it's probably better if you wait. Yeah.
This is a question for Robert Wade. Given India's response to the tsunami and quite a geopolitical response to not accept international financial support, what is your assessment of India's ability or success in terms of dealing with the immediate relief and now the reconstruction?
I'm afraid I have to plead ignorance, not something I'm used to doing, but I'm not following the case of India. It is the case in the most general way that India is, as you know, growing rapidly. There is a tremendous spirit in the air that India has finally overcome what used to be called the Hindu rate of growth, a very low, locked-in rate of growth, and that it is now on a trajectory to challenge the West, that it is now emerging into the ranks of the economic major powers. And I think that was the spirit in which India said that it would not take any international assistance. It was kind of a symbolic act.
Well, Tim's going to comment briefly, but I hope to say, Robert, that in this school you're only allowed one fail, and that's so all other questions you have to answer.
Well, again, this isn't something which I can claim a great deal of expertise about, but I would say, first of all, that I think India's had a long history of dealing with all sorts of tragedies which haven't generated the same response. I mean, the Orissa supercyclone of 1999, I think, is probably the most recent. Plus, there are all sorts of low magnitude, high frequency events of, you know, poverty, which India has been dealing with, which generally speaking have been largely ignored by the other countries. Plus, I would also echo what Robert said about there being a certain flavour within India, the BJP being in charge of certain nationalism, pride. We can do this by ourselves, thank you very much, which I think partly contributes towards that decision.
Next one, yeah, over there.
Thank you. My name is Sutiono from Indonesian Embassy. I just want to make a slight correction to Tim, and this is as a relation with what Robert has said about the acceptance of the Indonesian government on the debt relief program proposed by the G7. Up until now, the Indonesian government has no accept officially. We still have exercising, I'm studying what the proposal itself. But the idea is what Robert has said, that the writing off of the debt or some of the debt or giving a grant is more acceptable for us than just debt relief, which is, has a more fake idea on that. And secondly, I would like to ask Kirsten about the rebel itself. You're the expert of Aceh and the GAM. I'm just wondering why until 2 weeks or 3 weeks after the tsunami, the leaders of GAM in Sweden has not made any comment on the tsunami, which is, I suspect, this is kind of a, well, are they making a distance with their own people, or I don't know, it's something jumbling my head up until now. Thank you.
Well, it's not quite true that they haven't made any comments. They've issued a number of press releases accusing the Indonesian government of being slow, of the Indonesian military of getting in the way of aid efforts. At the same time, they have praised the foreign community coming in, and then they've called, in a sort of very bizarre twist, for peace talks in a sort of related yet unrelated way. And it's on the latter that you've actually have seen movement. They called a ceasefire right after the tsunami, which is not a particularly credible ceasefire given that there have been clashes really from the day after the ceasefire onwards. But there seems to be a movement towards getting talks going at the end of this month between the Indonesian government and the Free Aceh movement, starting with maybe a prolonged ceasefire and maybe more. That seems to be unclear, and people are a bit hedgy about what actually is on the table. So they have made comments, but I think one of the big challenges for the Free Aceh movement on the ground was that the areas that were hit, because they were coastal areas, were not areas where they were very prominent. During the past year, there has been a counterinsurgency operation in Aceh, which pushed the rebels away from the population centers into the mountains. So when the tsunami hit, the rebels were sitting in the mountains, and that cut them off from what was happening. It also left them in a position where they really couldn't provide any relevant aid to the people they claimed to represent. So they've had sort of struggle, the sort of big struggle for them was to maintain relevance in the face of the whole crisis.
Thank you. Woman there with a sort of mauve scarf. Yep.
Thank you. Following Dr. Schultz's comments on the relationship between the tsunami and possible peace talks with the Free Aceh movement, I wonder if any members of the panel can comment on the peace process in Sri Lanka and whether there's been any opening of possible extensions to the peace process or whether this is wishful thinking.
Got a no from Robert. Yeah, Tim.
Well, I only know what I read on the webs and on the newspapers, but as yet we can't really answer that question, but we're all watching intently. The latest report, which I read, which was this afternoon, said that the government is proposing rehousing, building new towns to bring people out of disaster-affected areas and building them together, but in the sort of social engineering sense of trying to bring different communities together to try and overcome the historic differences. And this is, on one hand, making a lot of people say, yes, this is a very sensible idea, but on the other hand, saying, actually, this is just going to fuel the discontent and the worry. I'm afraid I don't know which way will succeed, but I think at the moment it's still being worked out, and we don't really know the answer to that yet.
Thank you. Was there a question in the middle at the top? I'm not sure you've got a microphone. Have you got a microphone up there? No. But usually you can be heard if you project.
And it's referring to an article in Paris here last week about the six steps in which Bambam needs to put the economy in Indonesia. And one of the issues I thought was about the budget deficit, and Megawati government actually curtailed the budget deficit to a certain extent, and it's quite favourable in OECD terms. And my question is what extent is that going to increase with the result of actually the actual rebuilding efforts in ACTRE? And I ask that because, you know, the sort of contract, so because, you know, corruption has been sort of in
the most
corrupt countries in Asia, and
to
what extent is that
going to
have an impact on
the Kirsten, I think that's to you.
Sort of. I think if the pledges all follow through, the foreign pledges, that won't increase the debt. I think there will be enough there to reconstruct the areas hit by the tsunami. But then again, we go back to the issue raised by Drew, if they follow through, because really the history has not been particularly good by the foreign community. If they don't follow through, then you probably will see either an increase in debt trying to reconstruct, or you will see a halt in the reconstruction, which in turn would add more grievances to the ongoing conflict. So. And then the final issue on the corruption, I think that's a particularly a potentially risky situation in the sense that there have already been reports that aid money coming in is being corrupted by some parts by sort of fictitious NGOs plus parts of the remaining local government in Aceh. And that's a worrying sort of situation, because if the corruption increases, then that will obviously deter people from donating because they don't know where the money is going to go. And that will also increase the potential for renewed conflict, because corruption is one of the issues at the heart of the conflict, where the average person feels that they have not actually benefited from anything in Aceh for the last, well, really for the last 50 years. And if it then comes out that money that was supposed to be going to reconstruction of houses, fishing boats and streets and the rest of it is being corrupted, and and the sort of people who are receiving the money are local officials, that will, you know, pour oil onto the fire of the separatist conflict.
Robert?
Yeah, I just wanted to come in on this point about corruption, because this has become the focus of a lot of the debate about the tsunami. I refer to a newspaper article which goes under the headline, "Unlike tsunamis, comma, some disasters are man-made." The argument of this article is this, that Jeff Sachs has his argument backwards. It is the poverty, so the author says, it is the poverty of these nations, almost always caused by corruption or mistaken economic policies, which is why they are poor. And because they are poor, they can't respond to these kind of natural disasters. And the argument, the article goes on to make a case against very much aid, because the poverty of these nations is their own fault. That is due to corruption and failed economic policies. And so that argument is now beginning to get some teeth in order to justify a rather small-scale response. So you should be alert to that. And the second point I wanted to make about corruption has to do with the UN response, because partly in response to the US Congress's attacks on the UN in the case of the oil for food program in Iraq, the UN has really gone out of its way, the UN Secretariat has gone out of its way to put in place a system for making its expenditures in the tsunami-affected areas transparent, for making it possible for people around the world to see how this money is being spent, or at least that is the intention. And it has employed PricewaterhouseCoopers to devise such an information system. This is the way the UN is responding to the argument that because there's so much corruption, our money will be wasted, therefore we won't give. I don't know how the PricewaterhouseCoopers system is going in an area where all the infrastructure has been knocked out. That would be very interesting to know, but at least one should be aware that a really big effort is being made to put in place a transparent monitoring system by the UN.
Thanks. Now, there was somebody, yeah, man with glasses. No, you haven't got glasses on.
Hi, I'm the man with glasses from Development Studies Institute. I'm a student there. This question is for Professor Wade. After the tsunami, it seemed like there were two phases in the response. First, you had the heartwarming kind of stories about neighbors helping neighbors and people stepping over ethnic or religious lines to help one another. And in the second phase, you had the looters coming out and stealing the food from women and children. Similarly, I wonder if in the international arena, we see the positive response now, but in a few months or years, I wonder if the pressure is going to be ratcheted up using some of the tools that are being put in place now to impose further, say, adjustment programs or neoliberal economic agendas. And I wondered if you could comment on that at all.
Well, in another article, Janet Bush in the Independent Online certainly thinks that that is the case. Her article is titled, "Poor Nations Beware, There Are No Free Rides on the West's Dollars for Disasters Carousel." And this whole article is about the kind of conditionalities that the West is likely to go on placing on its aid. This is not so much policy conditionality as in liberalize your trade account and your capital account, but it's the kind that's been talked about in the case of Thailand, where we will lower our tariffs on your shrimp exports that will benefit your tsunami-affected people, but in return, you must buy our Airbus. I certainly think that this kind of linkage is going to be made, including in the U.S. One has to remember that in the U.S., much more than in Europe, the very ethical basis of aid is much more contested. The idea that taxpayers' money should be used for charitable purposes is an idea that arouses much more opposition there than it does in Europe. President Bush said in the last few days that he encourages private donations, and he particularly recommended that private individuals and charities make their contributions to the tsunami relief additional on all their other giving. But he was noticeably quiet about whether this same principle of additionality would apply to US public sector funds, for the reason that a lot of the US contributions will not be additional. They will be taken, as has been said, from elsewhere, from Africa and from Honduras and other such places, for the reason that I said, that aid is so much more contested in its very fundamentally ethical notion of aid is much more contested there.
Thanks. At the second row here on the left-hand side.
My question just relates to a couple of the comments which have come from the panel, which somewhat stunned me in relation to the early warning systems and how it seems to be accepted that the 2 or 3 hours, I in fact heard it was slightly more, that the time between when it was first registered and when it reached, for example, Sri Lanka, that wasn't enough to do anything about it. Now, when we're talking about the scale of devastation, how many people died, and when I understand that you only had to move 1 kilometer inland in order to escape the immediate effects of the disaster, what standard are we applying when we say that we assume that nothing could have been done? I think in a world where we're infinitely ingenious about ways of destroying things, I think it's, especially with the information technology, most of Sri Lanka is completely literate. Most have radios, some have televisions. Does the panel honestly think that nothing could have been done now in order to get people 1 kilometre away from the coastline?
David?
I didn't say nothing could be done. but I don't think it's a panacea, the early warning system at the moment, but technology will advance over time. There is no record of a tsunami affecting India. There is no record of a tsunami affecting Sri Lanka. The return period, the calculated return period for a tsunami with a 10-meter run-up, which is about what this is way over 1,000 years. The last earthquake-generated tsunami in the Indian Ocean was in 1833. It's not like the Pacific, which is surrounded by subduction zones, and the Pacific's had 400 tsunamis in the 20th century, where they have taken a death toll of 50,000. What we're dealing with here is a very unusual, very rare, very high magnitude, very low frequency event. Now, what sort of event do we plan for in the future? All right? Do we plan for this sort of event, or do we plan for a smaller event? Had the earthquake, which was 9 on the Richter scale, been 8 on the Richter scale, a relatively small tsunami would have hit Sri Lanka, virtually nothing at all. So the full-blown warning system is actually designed for an event which is only remotely possible. Now, I'm not saying it shouldn't be done, and I think it politically has to be done, but had we done a risk assessment before December the 25th, the risk of tsunami-induced damage would have been perceived as relatively small.
If I could just ask a quick follow-up question. My question wasn't so much protecting against tsunamis, but the transmittal of information. What I'm saying is it could have very easily been said, move 1 kilometer inland. I think any developed country in the world, I know Australia, if you're at a beach and there is a warning about a shark, within seconds there will be helicopters going up and down the beach and announcing that people can get out of the water now. What sort of a world are we living in when we're saying that we can't transmit a message within 3.5 hours to a coastal zone and say to people to live in England? Apparently the gentleman who is monitoring the Hawaiian coastline, his answer to some of the questions was, it's not my job to transmit information. I'm not saying, but these signs, how do people know what a tsunami is? But people understand to live in England.
There's going to be a flood.
It just stuns me.
Thanks.
Very little awareness of tsunamis in Sri Lanka and in India for the reasons that I've given you. Secondly, the time available is very, very short. Thirdly, actually identifying whether an earthquake, a submarine earthquake, has actually generated a tsunami requires not just the identification of the earthquake, but actually monitoring the tsunami as it is passing by pressure-sensitive devices and buoys and things like that. That cuts down the time, all right? So that in fact the actual time available when you are fairly certain there is a tsunami of unknown size is now very short indeed. So there's very limited time. And if you actually have lots of false alarms, then your warning system becomes totally useless because people don't take any notice of it. So this difficulty, there will be a tsunami warning system. It will probably be based on various sorts of sirens. There will be a much greater awareness of tsunamis in this part of the world. The time that will elapse before the next one, goodness only knows, could be hundreds of years.
The question, same row, just two along.
Hi, my name is Kim, and my question, I guess, goes in a different direction from the angle that we've been looking at. Many areas in the Pacific, and perhaps Florida, which we remember has been hit by so many tornadoes in such a short time. I was just wondering, like for those sort of regions, they have managed to securitize the risks associated with these natural calamities, such that even once they do occur, the developmental funds are there at the ready, and it's just a matter of dispersing them and getting them to the regions that are affected and assisting in relief efforts and coordination and the logistical aspects of the relief operations. And so my question is, what do the panel think would be a feasible solution, perhaps for the tsunami affected regions, developing such sort of security such that even when these calamities do occur again, God willing they won't, but should they occur again, there's immediate funds to help in reconstruction, and so it's not a matter of waiting for the West to come to the aid.
Tim, any thoughts on that? Robert? No, Robert's declined. Once again, no? I mean, I have to say, I'm not quite sure, when you say securitization, what do you mean exactly? It's always tempting to think that investment banks are the solution to all problems, as well as the manufacturers of many of them, but I think the reason for blankness here, they're not quite following.
What I mean is by means of catastrophe bonds. These are issued by a particular region, say the state of Florida, that says we anticipate that the probability of this hurricane or this disaster of this sudden magnitude will carry along a certain expected loss. And from that, they work out with their tables and sort of things like that, what the price of the premium of the bond should be and things like that. And so the region, and these are sold to investors who'll be willing to invest in these bonds. And at the moment that the risk actually does occur, you have funds being immediately disbursed to the region to help in redevelopment.
Sort of cat bonds, Robert, do you think that's realistic?
Well, you're the one who should answer.
Yeah, but I'm in the chair.
Okay, well, just let me make one point, and then I'll hand it over to you, because you are the expert in this. In principle, it might be in some sense a good idea, but I think that the chances that governments would do this, would allocate foreign exchange in this kind of way, are extremely small. I'm thinking of what happened in the case of, in the years before the Asian crisis of 1997. What happened was that because these countries had records of 10, 20, 30 years of solid growth, people stopped hedging their foreign exchange borrowing. Now, in retrospect, everybody said, oh my God, we should have been hedging these loans so that if there was a sharp devaluation, we wouldn't get hit. We should have, but the companies just, the finance managers of companies just told their people, forget it, we're not going to spend money taking out this insurance because these things won't happen. And I think that the same kind of thinking would apply to your idea of catastrophe bonds. I just don't think it's going to happen.
I think, if I might add, that there's a demand side and a supply side here. I suspect that Robert is right looking at the demand side. I also feel that this may well be in the category of infrequent risk, which is impossible to price. I mean, there were elements, for example, of the 9/11 catastrophe that were not covered because it was not possible to price that kind of risk. And I think that the market, there is, in fact, a market failure in this kind of area because markets are highly reluctant to price risks of this kind, where the payout is massive and the probability is extremely low. And there are other examples, in fact, of types of insurance that you cannot get. I mean, the most vivid example, I guess, was in this country after the Broadgate IRA bomb in, I think, 93, it was no longer possible to get terrorism insurance for large commercial buildings in the city, and the government had effectively to step in and provide its own kind of reinsurance. In fact, the government, bizarrely, has made a notional profit on this insurance because there hasn't been that kind of event. But the market was not actually prepared to price it, so the government had to take it as an internal paper entry risk. I mean, there were no actual bonds issued. And I suspect that if you did, as Sri Lanka or as Indonesia, go into the market and say, would you price me a catastrophe bond, you would not get an answer, except at a price that you would not be prepared to pay. Let me take one at the back there. I'm sort of slightly discriminating in favour of people with specs, but...
Spectacles and a dog collar. Raymond Perrier from Student in Human Rights. Just to return to the point about warning systems, it struck me that it took at least 6 attempts to clear the library earlier when our very sophisticated, technically advanced warning system trying to evacuate the library. But my question was whether any of the panel would speculate on how different the reaction of the international community might have been if 200,000 people had been killed on the coastline of America or conversely of Africa.
Jude?
I'm not going to comment on whether it would have been different in terms of the coast of America, but sitting in Indonesia at the time, I can, and watching what I saw on the foreign TV compared to what I saw on Indonesian TV, it struck me that there was an awful lot of time spent on white tourists in Thailand who were accounting for their ruined holidays while there were thousands and thousands, hundred thousands of dead in Aceh. And that was just something that sort of struck me personally. So I assume that if we put the same disaster in America, there would be probably even more TV and, you know, maybe a bit of hysteria added to it. I'll hand over to you.
I don't
want
to. For the question then, the third row, there are two women there, I'll take both of you. Why don't you both ask your question and we'll take them together.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm from Sri Lanka, and first of all, I would like to say that people in Sri Lanka are very appreciative and are profoundly grateful for the generous response and for all the help we are receiving. So it's just a chance to say thank you as well. My question is that has the UN reached its targets for the funding for the relief and the reconstruction, or should more sustainable sources of funding be put in place, bearing in mind the long-term nature of the rehabilitation needed?
Jonah, I'll have yours as well, thanks.
I'll take mine as well. Okay, I had a more specific question about Aceh, and it's in two regards. One is the impact of the role of the military that they're playing right now in aid coordination, and the impact that that may have not on the rebels so much as the local community organizers, both Acehese and Indonesian. Because I've been receiving reports, you know, I read these reports that come from the civil society coalitions very regularly, and the latest one that just came out today was talking about the fact that there are certain areas where, in fact, volunteers are not able to directly distribute aid because they have to coordinate it with the military, which is centralizing aid. So that's the first one. What is the impact, negative and positive perhaps, of the role of the military in this aid coordination? Secondly, what is the impact of the policies that the UN is taking or other actors in the international community on these local organizations and local initiatives? Also quite worrying in this report was an indication that because UNHCR has started to pay locals to help with storing up aid within the warehouses, that in fact the local voluntary groups were not able to get the manpower to do this sort of work anymore. Then there was another report that, again, UNHCR was paying higher tariffs than normal for cargo ships that were coming from Medan, and this has, in fact, impacted a huge increase, up to 300 to 500% of a tariff raise. And of course, voluntary groups from throughout Indonesia, but also throughout the Southeast Asian region, are obviously not able to sustain their own efforts within this kind of context.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Kirsten to deal with the second question while Robert thinks about the first.
Okay. I think I'll start with the latter part. Now, I don't know about the UNHCR paying, but I do know about other voluntary groups who are having problems trying to get their aid to Banda Aceh, groups who are working out of Jakarta, for example, Muhammadiyah, which is one of the largest Muslim organizations, and they had bought lots of body bags, which they wanted to give to their volunteers to help with the body recovery effort, and they couldn't get them on any plane. The Australians refused to take them, the Americans refused to take them, the normal airliners wanted to charge. And in the end, they had this sort of big argument, and one of the airliners then relented and said, no, we will take them for free, but this is a one-off. And that's sort of the scenario that these voluntary groups are struggling with. And I can imagine that with respect to the UN, which of course has more resources, there would be an impact if they start to pay local people, and obviously if you sort of look at it from the perspective of the locals who've just lost their livelihood, they would of course stream towards organizations where they do get a salary for helping out. So there's a bit of a competition going on in that respect. With respect to the military, there have been both positive and negative effects. The positive effect was that the military, because it had been in the area as a result of the conflict, was right there when it happened and was at the front of digging out the bodies. So the first sort of pictures before the volunteers started streaming into Aceh to help out, it was really very much the military and the police who were doing the sort of body recovery. And that put the military in a sort of positive light, and the population was actually very, very grateful for this. On the negative side, because the conflict is of course still going on, and the areas that have been hit by the tsunami are really only the coastal areas, and you have the whole rest of the province still in a state of conflict, has meant that there are areas which are not secure, and where there still has been shooting, there have been clashes, there have been reports about rebel interception with aid convoys, not attacks on foreign aid workers. The rebels don't have an interest in shooting foreigners, but there have been some interception of convoys, and there have also been reports of soldiers sort of who have a history of, who in the past have been very suspicious about foreign involvement, also getting overzealous in restricting foreigners delivering aid. And here you have to put it in the context that the UN and NGOs played a primary role in the push for independence of East Timor. And the military was very much worried that with all these NGOs now on the ground, that there might be a repeat of the scenario. So you've had, while at the top from both the GAM leadership and the military, there have been orders to restrain hostilities on the ground. That's not necessarily the way it has been played out. And that's been detrimental to the aid effort as a whole.
Thanks. Robert, on whether the UN will meet its commitments.
Well, the commitments could be, however the targets are set, the commitments could be almost infinitely expandable. The important thing is that a clear distinction be made between expenditure on immediate relief, such as body identification, such as the restoration of clean water supply, that kind of thing, which can be, must be done quickly, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the restoration of livelihoods. The restoration of livelihoods is going to be very slow. I mean, if you think just of the fisher people, they will need boats. They will need, many of them will need quite large boats, as we saw in the photographs, boats with engines, boats which are very expensive, and thousands of them, in order to begin to restore livelihoods. The important point is that the UN must not be under pressure to spend quickly, because if it is, in the second category of restoration of livelihoods, because if it is, there will be all kinds of corruption. It will be very difficult to monitor the expenditures. So that is the unfortunate fact. The expenditure will have to go slowly. It will have to be closely monitored. And it will have to go on for quite a long time. And therefore, the question of how that fund is organized and kept intact for long-term purposes is really important.
Well, I'm afraid we're pretty much at the end of our time. And I did have one write-in question that I wanted to put. And Jude, who's got off lightly, is going to get it first. And that is, if the panelists had a holiday booked to Phuket in March, would they be pressing ahead with it? Now, this is theoretical because LSE professors can't afford to go on holidays of that sort, but supposing you could. Jude?
I wouldn't go in March because I think there is so much that has to be done to restore immediate livelihoods in order, but I would book a holiday 1 year down the road, if I could get permission to go away in March.
Kirsten, because you've been to there recently,
I'm
but not
going
on holiday.
To Phuket, but I will be going back to Aceh in March because my friends want to see me, so moral support.
David?
March is too soon.
Well, curiously enough, I was in fact going to go to Sri Lanka in March. Bizarrely, you may think, looking at me, to play cricket, but actually, the Sri Lankan end has cancelled this, which I guess is understandable in the circumstances. Thank you very much for coming. We've only scratched the surface of the implications of this, but and thank you to the panel. Thank you.